You are about to hear the actual voices of some of America's great poets, past and present. The voices of Walt Whitman and James Whitcomb Riley to the voices of Robert Frost and William Carlos Williams.
You are listening to Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, a transcribed feature of the NBC News and Special Events Department. This week, our subject is American poets. And now to introduce you to some of the great American poets of the past and present, here is Leon Pearson.
The United States, best known for power and progress in material things, has also brought to the world a fresh and stimulating idea of what poetry can be and how close it can come to being a part of our lives. Whitman did this as a pioneer, and Sandburg and Masters and Frost and now Williams, yes, and many others, they revolted from the idea that poetry must deal with ancient and classical themes. Whitman, addressing himself to the muse, said, "Come, muse, migrate from Greece and Ionia." And again he said, "Placard removed and to let on the rocks of your snowy Parnassus. For know a better, fresher, busier sphere, a wider, untried domain awaits, demands you." And the muse has answered. Answered with what is perhaps the one supreme contribution of American poetry to the literature of our times. Finding beauty in simple things and expressing it in free and unfettered forms. What we have of Whitman today is not so remarkable for what it says as for the fact that the words are spoken in Whitman's own voice. This is a recording made in 1890 on one of the earliest cylindrical gramophones. This is the only known recording of Whitman's voice obtained from the remarkable Roscoe Haley collection in New York. When it first came to us, this recording was battered and almost unintelligible. Our engineers went to work on it with filters and other electronic devices and have restored it enough to bring out the earnest tones of Whitman's voice. It was not possible to eliminate from the background the whir of the old cylinder, but the voice rises clearly above that. For the greater clarity, let me give you first the words that Whitman speaks from his short poem, America. Strong, ample, fair, enduring, capable, rich, perennial with the earth, with freedom, law, and love. Now, Walt Whitman.
America, center of equal daughters, equal sons, all alike and good, grown, ungrown, young or old, strong, ample, fair, enduring, capable, rich, perennial with the earth, with freedom, law, and love.
The America Whitman was writing about has come a long way since then, and stands today the greatest power on earth with responsibilities and taxes never known before. Whitman seemed to foresee this before the turn of the century when he wrote these words. It all seems as if the Almighty God had spread before this nation charts of imperial destinies dazzling as the sun, but behold the cost. If you would have greatness, know that you must pay for it with a proportionate price. James Whitcomb Riley dealt less with the great forces and emotions of life, more with the homespun patterns and Hoosier homilies. But he is part of the American tradition of creating poetic beauty out of the scenes and events of daily life. As long ago as 1903, Riley himself read for recording his own poem, Out to Old Aunt Mary's, or rather part of it. Here again, the quality is not very good, and I'm going to read the lines, stanza by stanza, and then give you Riley's voice. Actually, the first line has been lost from the recording, but the complete first stanza goes like this. Wasn't it pleasant, O brother mine, in those old days of the lost sunshine of youth, when the Saturday's chores were through, and the Sunday's wood in the kitchen too, and we went visiting, me and you, out to old Aunt Mary's?
In those old days of the lost sunshine of youth, when the Saturday's chores were through, and the Sunday's wood in the kitchen too, and we went visiting, me and you, out to old Aunt Mary's.
It all comes back so clear today, though I am as bald as you are gray. Out by the barn lot and down the lane, we patter along in the dust again, as light as the tips of the drops of the rain, out to old Aunt Mary's.
It all comes back so clear today, though I am as bald as you are gray. Out by the barn lot and down the lane, We patter along in the dust again, as light as the tips of the drops of the rain, out to old Aunt Mary.
We crossed the pasture and through the wood, where the old gray snag of the poplar stood, where the hammering redheads hopped awry, and the buzzard raised in the clearing sky and lolled and circled as we went by, out to old Aunt Mary's.
We crossed the pasture and through the wood, where the old gray snag of the poplar stood, where the hammering redheads hopped awry, and the buzzards raised in the clearing sky and lolled and circled as we went by, up to old Aunt Mary.
But strong and clear is the voice of Edwin Markham, reading his best-known poem, the poem which made him famous, The Man with the Hoe. This is a more recent recording, and it brings out sharply the western twang of his voice, and also the emphasis with which he bears down on the social injustice that he saw in looking into Millet's painting, the work that inspired the poem.
The man with the hoe, bowed by the weight of centuries, he leans upon his hoe and gazes on the ground, the emptiness of ages in his face, and on his back the burden of the world. Who made him dead to rapture and despair, a thing that grieves not and that never hopes, stolid and stunned, a brother to the ox? Who loosened and let down this brutal jaw? Whose was the hand that slanted back this brow? Whose breath blew out the light within this brain? Is this the thing the Lord God made and gave to have dominion over sea and land, to trace the stars and search the heavens for power, to feel the passion of eternity? Is this the dream he dreamed, who shaped the suns and marked their ways upon the ancient deep? Down all the caverns of hell to their last gulf, there is no shape more terrible than this, more tongue with cries against the world's blind greed, more filled with signs and portents for the soul, more packed with danger to the universe. What gulfs between him and the seraphim? Slave of the wheel of labor? What to him are Plato and the swing of Pleiades? What the long reaches of the peaks of song, the rift of dawn, the reddening of the rose? Through this dread shape, the suffering ages look.
The poetry attempted by Robert Frost in his early years was so unfamiliar to the ears of American editors that the now famous volume North of Boston first found a publisher not in this country, but in England. But now, the pleasant, conversational, and revealing pentameter of Robert Frost has become an American tradition. Frost invited the reader to a friendly visit, much as if the reader were there on the farm and could go along to clean the pasture spring. I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. I'll only stop to rake the leaves away and wait to watch the water clear, I may. I shan't be gone long. You come too. I'm going out to fetch the little calf that's standing by the mother. It's so young, it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I shan't be gone long. You come too. But there are no tones for hearing Frost like the tones of Frost himself. For he was the very New England farmer he writes about, and whose reflective and perplexing thoughts came in moments of solitude. Here is the poet reading The Road Not Taken. Listen to the expression of pathos, without effort or strain, as he reflects on what might have happened in his life.
Two roads diverged in a yellow wood. And sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other as just as fair and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by. And that has made all the difference.
American colleges and universities have bid so handsomely for the private appearance of poets reading their own works that poets such as Robert Frost and Vachel Lindsay and Edna St. Vincent Millay have become known almost as much for their public appearances as for their publications. And in the same way, they have become good readers. In Miss Millay's brief poem called Travel, we hear, as she reads it, that breathless and romantic feeling the words were intended to convey.
The railroad track is miles away, and the day is loud with voices speaking. Yet there isn't a train goes by all day, but I hear its whistle shrieking. All night there isn't a train goes by, though the night is still for sleep and dreaming. But I see its cinders red on the sky, and hear its engine steaming. My heart is warm with the friends I make, and better friends I'll not be knowing. Yet there isn't a train I wouldn't take, no matter where it's going.
The effect of modern trends in American poetry has been to evoke all sorts of outpouring, some good, some just versifying for fun. Here, from the pen of an anonymous poet, are some lines suggesting the fruitless confusion of holiday traffic on a main highway. This is called Highway Fantasia. Among the low New Hampshire hills that fraternize with Maine, a highway takes the tourist out and leads him back again. Here are the hills his fathers knew, the graves where his fathers lie. Though beauty is there, he is little aware. What does he seek and why? 40, 50, 55, that bird does it and he's alive. Pity on the pokey, pass him, pity on the parson, pokey, parson. Bus, truck, pass him, tank, coop, pass him. A grove of birches, a lily pond. No, we're a mile and a half beyond. You take in the country scene. I can't stop, the light's green. Beverly, Hampton, pass him, Kittery, Biddeford, pass him. Pity on the pokey, pity on the pokey. Whoosh, whoosh. Deep in the heart of the woodland, the willow is at prayer, and weird is the call of the veery amid the silence there. Behind a blue eternal hill, the sun in glory dies. A lonely pine tree has its will of whispering with the skies. And now to Dr. William Carlos Williams. During the next 6 weeks, Dr. Williams is going to be very much in the literary news. His autobiography is scheduled for publication by Random House, and his epic poem, Patterson, one of the most ambitious works of poetry by an American, is scheduled for publication in its entirety by New Directions Press. Dr. Williams is notable not only for his poetry, but also for his versatility. At the age of 68, he still carries on a flourishing medical practice in the town of Rutherford, New Jersey, where he was born. Dr. Williams is a slight, erect, vigorous man with close-cropped gray hair and fine features. You would spot him for a country doctor rather than a poet, and looking at him, you would scarcely believe that many regard him as a difficult poet, as difficult for many people to understand today as Walt Whitman was in the late 19th century. But conversationally, there is nothing at all difficult about Dr. Williams. Jack Gerber of the NBC News and Special Events staff interviewed Dr. Williams in his home to find out what it is that makes a poet. What kind of a person is a poet? How does one get started writing poetry? Here is Dr. Williams.
Well, all right, I was born, that's where we begin usually, born right in Rutherford of parents who were themselves born out of the country. I went to Horace Mann High School in New York City. My brother and I commuted from here. I had some very good English teachers at Horace Mann. There was an Uncle Billy Abbott, and I believe that Uncle Billy Abbott was the first one who really led me toward English, toward writing, toward the satisfaction of externalizing my sorrows and distresses. And believe me, that's the way writing often starts, a disaster or a catastrophe of some sort has happened to me, and you're a child not knowing where to go or what to do or what to think. He's thrown back so much on himself that he's really in distress. And if someone can teach him through an art or through an interest in whatever it may be to externalize his sorrows, like the sorrows of Werther, he immediately is put on a good basis for life if he can continue it. And I think that's the basis for my continued interest in writing. Because by writing, I rescue myself under all sorts of conditions when I'm... whatever it may be that has upset me or some trouble that I've got myself into through my excessive energy, let's say, if there is any at times, then I can write and it relieves the feeling of distress. I think quite literally, psychologically, speaking as Freud might think, that writing has meant that to me all the way through. I started to write. I even remember the first thing I ever wrote, because it was a sudden, it was a crisis. It was shortly after I had been forbidden to go into athletics, told that I shouldn't undertake anything too strenuous in life. I spontaneously said to myself, "A black, black cloud flew over the sun, driven by fierce flying rain." Well, immediately I thought, well, that's the most stupid thing I've ever said, because, after all, the rain doesn't drive the clouds. So at the same moment, I was born a poet and a critic instantly. And I've never forgotten either one. But the outstanding thing was that when I said that, I experienced a pleasure. A real pleasure, a delightful feeling, as if I had done something outstanding. I had no idea what I'd done. I did plenty. Ruined myself for life. But from being a regular guy, I became a poet. That horrible thing. But it was a satisfaction, and it's continued ever since.
Many, many poets have talked about being lonely.
Mm. I think the artist, generally speaking, feels lonely. Perhaps his very recourse to art in any form comes from his essential loneliness. He is usually in rebellion against the world. I think that's a rule. I have thought myself that that's a rather a snide thing to say. Here I'm living with my wife and child and saying I'm lonely. It merely records a fact.
Yes, but you, more than most artists, are also living in a community and doing a job in a community.
Yes, it's true. But if you do your job, you're most lonely. Strange as it may seem, because in your ordinary work, and there's your incentive for art all the way through, you yourself, as a man, as a woman, as an individual, are very seldom completely involved in your own work. And that answers, to some extent, the question, how do you find time for writing? It's a necessity, because the essential I, the person himself, does his work, but remains, after the work is finished, there he stays, like a man who arrives at the age of 65 and retires or is retired by his firm, and when he gets all through, he finds that he doesn't exist and never has existed, poor guy. He never knew it before. He thought that the job was everything in his life. Well, he's finished. He's absolutely finished. He goes out and shoots himself very often. There is nothing left of him. And I wanted to make very sure that that was not going to happen to me, baby. No, sir. I knew that if I lived long enough, I was going to be old. And after I became old, then life really would begin, as I've said over and over again. Then I would be retired because I've served. I've done my stuff. I've done my stuff for society. And what's left is my time. I believe certain things. I feel that certain things disastrous things are happening in the world because of man's stupidity, definite stupidity. I can't do anything about it. Personally, either as a physician or as a citizen, I can do very little but vote, which is a mechanical gesture of some value. Of course, I acknowledge it and I always vote. But in my mind, I've so far gone beyond any of the formal pretexts of politics, whether I'm entirely right or not is another thing, that they seem old hat, most of it. I mean, humanly, they are. Every man of any sense knows that the brutality of the world has to be outgrown, that's all. And we outgrow it in our art, in the technique of our art, in the way the line is put down, in the way the colors are applied. I think that the artist really, basically, within himself, is always among the most advanced men of any period. They are the ones who symbolize their thought in their works, and so are always laughed at, inevitably, too, because our first reaction is laughter to anything we don't know, laughter or murderous designs. The artist is way ahead of his age in his general thought, and so is lonely. Lonely. That's where the loneliness comes from.
Well, if I could bring another man's work into this
yes?
for a minute.
Yes,
have a poem here by Archibald MacLeish that I came across the other day that is kind of relevant.
Yes.
Do you know his Invocation to the Social Muse?
I just know the name.
Well, he speaks here of this very thing, and then his final question is, is it just to demand of us also to bear arms, speaking of the poet?
Yes. Well, I'd answer the question by saying we must bear arms. In one book of poems called The Tempers, I say that the writing of the poem is part of the war. I'm not anxious to rush off and bear arms. But if I should be asked to bear arms, I would do it gladly. And I'd probably be a good soldier. Because I know that I am, after all, one microscopic person. No matter what I may think, or no matter whether I believe that I'm doing something valuable or not. And I think a proper citizen of any country or any group should submit himself to the rule of the group in an emergency. I think there are reasons why we should rebel at times and voice it and go down without a murmur. I don't believe in trying to escape it or lying or cheating or trying to subvert the government by falsity. That I would absolutely oppose in anything. Come out straight, face it, and stand up and get it in the face and say, thank you, sir, go ahead and shoot me, I'm much obliged. But that's what I think a man is, and I think a poet belongs there.
I wonder if we could get to your poetry again now.
Yes?
Some questions. Let's take just the simple little poem about the plums.
It's curious how a thing of this sort, which was really just a passing gesture, it actually took place just as it says here. And my wife being out, I left the note for her just that way. And she replied very beautifully, unfortunately, I've lost it. I think what she wrote was quite as good as this. A little more complex, but quite as good. This, perhaps the virtue of this is its simplicity. Well, let's have it then. This is just to say, I have eaten the plums that were in the icebox and which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me. They were delicious, so sweet and so cold.
Now, what I want to ask you about that, what makes that a poem?
In the first place, it's metrically absolutely regular. This is just to say, I've eaten the plums that were in the icebox and which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me, they were delicious, so sweet and so cold. So, dogmatically speaking, it has to be a poem because it goes that way, don't you see?
Well, this goes against so many preconceived ideas of poems, though, because it's the kind of thing that almost anybody might say.
Yes, because no one believes that poetry can exist in his own life. That's one of our immediate fallacies, that nothing, some Englishman said, imagine reading a poem in the American dialect. How impossible. Well, that's the first hazard. That's the first hurdle. We have to get over that. That it has nothing to do with the way it's said. Oh, we'd have something to do because it can be badly read and otherwise. But we can't believe that we poor colonials, as we have been ever since the revolution, we poor people who are not living in the great centers of Europe could have anything happen in our lives important enough to be put down in words and given a form. But everything in our lives, if it's sufficiently authentic to our lives and touches us deeply enough with a certain amount of feeling, is capable of being organized into a form which can be a poem. In fact, those simple difficulties, those things which are at the base of all the English departments and all the universities in the world and make them all asinine because they're usually 20 years back at the times, are the things that make it impossible to hear a poem. We can't even hear it anymore because we don't believe it can happen in our lives, our own lives, you know. As if we were Greeks who have been dead 2,000 years. We're not yet dead, most of us. Some are living on, quite dead. But you have to get used to the fact that in your own life, that which touches you, such as your affection for your wife, I think that's material for a poem. That's really a definite poem without even writing it. But then if you can give it conventional metrical form, why, my God, you're just simply superb, that's all. You've done a great deed. So that's part of my theory, you see.
Find one of your poems there that has a lot of good American in it.
Let me see. Let's take Old Bunk's Band.
Fine.
Old Bunk, you see, the theory is that you can make a poem out of anything. You don't have to have conventionally poetic material. Anything that is felt, and that is felt deeply, or deeply enough, or even that gives amusement, is material for art. This is Old Bunk's Band. These are men, the gaunt, unforesold, the vocal, blatant, stand up, stand up, the slap of a bass string, pick-ping, the horn, the hollow horn, long drawn out, a hound deep tone, choking, choking, while the treble reed races alone, ripples, screams, slow to fast, to second to first. These are men. Drum, 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 drum. The ancient cry, escaping crapulence, eats through, transcendent, torn, tears, term, town, tense, turns and backs off whole, leaps up, stomps down, rips through. These are men, beneath whose force the melody limps, to proclaim, proclaims, run and lie down in slow measures to rest, and not never need no more. These are men, men. Wallace Stevens liked this other one, El Hombre, which is very short. Yeah. El Hombre, because I was sick and tired of French titles. You know how the arty person loves to talk French.
Yes.
Whether he can talk French or not, he always has to use a French term. That shows that he's smart, I suppose. Well, in order to change that around, I thought Spanish was a good language, too. Very much neglected language. And this is El Hombre, the man. It's a strange courage you bring me, ancient star. Shine alone in the sunrise, toward which you lend no part.
This is Leon Pearson again with a final word. The American poet has been looking, as Edgar Lee Masters put it, looking at life all around me, here in the village, all in the loom, and oh, what patterns. He has looked, and he has been moved to write in the American way.
You have been listening to Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, a transcribed feature of the NBC News and Special Events Department.